First case for oral argument this morning before the court is the State of South Dakota versus Derek Crothers. For the appellant, Mr. Crothers, is Mr. Sean O'Brien, an attorney from Brookings. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Gary Campbell, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. O'Brien, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Gilbertson. May it please the court. Your Honors, I think this is a case of prosecution which got off to a bad start from the very beginning. And what I mean by that is at the time that the allegations were made and the police became involved and they decided to question my client, they picked him up in a police vehicle from a farm, took him down to police headquarters, and proceeded to question and interrogate him at the bottom of the police station. Two police officers asking my client questions. The problem is, Your Honors, I see is that he was never advised of his Miranda rights, which he should have been entitled to receive, because I believe in that situation he was in custodial custody and being interrogated by the police. At that point in time, Your Honors, the police had their man, in their opinion. They had received the reports from the investigating officer and from others, and they weren't out looking to find out what was going on. They knew what was going on, and they wanted to try to get incriminating statements from my client, and they knew full well that he was not represented by counsel, and yet they failed to advise him of his Miranda rights. Now, as the court is aware, these Miranda rights are not very long or complicated or sophisticated, and they take approximately 10 minutes or 10 seconds, excuse me, to state. And why would they not go through that simple procedure and advise him of his rights? He was interrogated for over 90 minutes. It was a two-on-one situation, and I believe, Your Honor, that was the first mistake that was made. The second mistake proceeded with the grand jury proceedings and the state's attorney. And the record is clear that in grand jury proceedings, the courts and the prosecution are governed by the rules of evidence. And the rules of evidence state that you are not to ask leading and suggestive questions. Now, there are certain exceptions, and especially in the case of this young child, you are permitted to ask leading questions to the extent to try to develop the testimony, but in this case, the state went way beyond trying to develop the testimony. And in fact, if the court were to review the transcript of the grand jury proceedings, it becomes extremely obvious to anyone that it was the state's attorney that was actually introducing the evidence to the grand jurors and simply asking this young child to try to state yes or no to the questions that were being asked of her. Compounding that problem was the fact that the state's attorney asked one witness, and I believe this is a quote, "I assume you were unfamiliar with his record," meaning the defendant's record. And again, the purpose of that question was to paint my client in a bad light as being a bad guy to the grand jurors. And as this court is aware, there's a two-part test, and before you go ahead and make any determination of whether you introduce any prior bad acts to the jurors. And in this case, the state's attorney went way overboard in trying to get the grand jury to believe that my client was guilty just based upon his prior record. So
what's the remedy, would you see, in this case, then?
The remedy, Your Honor, we would like to have a retrial, and I think we need to just do it right the next time around.
Well, if the jury convicted your client in a jury trial, what is the harm to him based on your observations of the irregularities in the grand jury? The grand jury didn't put him in prison. The criminal jury
well,
did.
Thank you, Your Honor, for the question. But the grand jury is the very beginning proceeding that if the grand jurors do not produce the indictment, then there's no trial. So I would argue then that that in this case, we should go back and the state should be required to proceed again with the grand jury indictment or else preliminary hearing as a remedy. Next, Your Honors, and I think the key question in this case has to do with the child and whether she was competent to testify and whether she was available as a witness, as that term is defined by statute. And I believe, Your Honors, if you look at the, not only if you look at the trial transcript, but look, beginning with the grand jury transcript, and then proceeding along with the motions hearing that the state provided their notice of intent to produce other evidence, and the child testified at that time, and then again at the time of the trial when the child testified, I will think you'll find throughout a consistency in her testimony that she was unable to recollect things that occurred when she was 4 years old. And this trial took place about 2 years later when she was 6 years old. And even before the trial, when the grand jury was convened and the child was testifying in front of the grand jury, she was unable to recollect things that had, that she allegedly had told her mother at the time she was 4 years old. She was unable to recollect things that she was doing when she was 4 years old. Your Honor, she made statements to the court that you know, she really didn't know the difference between right and wrong. She was really unable to testify in this case. It's too bad, and I don't know how you make the record of it, but the court, Judge Gienapp, did make reference to the fact that throughout the trial, in more than one occasion, and quite frankly, probably in a majority of the time, when the child was asked questions, there was a long, long pause between the time the question was asked and the time that she would, the child would give a response. And sometimes, Your Honors, she did not give a response. And so the question had to be asked time and time again to try to elicit some type of response. This child was sitting on the lap of the victim assistant who she knew, was friends with her, and bought toys for her, and had reviewed some of the tapes that had been previously made by a child's voice. Despite all of that, this child was simply unable to recollect and to testify as to anything that may have occurred to her when she was 4 years old. And it was simply the testimony and the questions, the leading questions that were asked by the state's attorney. Didn't this happen? Didn't that happen? And what did you do after he did this? And simply, she was just being asked to answer questions, yes or no, or I don't know. And that was the majority of the answers that she gave to the testimony throughout the grand jury proceedings, the motion hearing, and at the time of trial. Your Honor, I think your previous decisions are clear that in this type of case involving this type of issue, you really have to look at the facts of each and every case, and they're different, obviously, one case to the next. And so, and this court has issued decisions in McCafferty stating that in that case the child was unavailable. The court has issued decisions going the other way too, I believe Guthmiller case. But so I think what it's important for Your Honors to do is to review the transcript of these hearings and of the trial to make your own determination of whether you believe that this child was the one testifying or not. And I believe that a fair reading of the trial transcript would show that she was not testifying. It was simply the state's attorney that was doing so.
Well, we read the transcripts, but Judge Gienapp, who tried the case, got to watch this child and look at her and make an assessment. And we all know, having had children and being around children, it makes a big difference if you can see them, making that judgment whether they're forthcoming or not and know what they're talking about. Why is it that we should overrule Judge Gienapp on this?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, in all due respect to Judge Gienapp, that he made a mistake in his determination, and that was abuse of discretion on his part. And I would ask this court to review the testimony of the child and to come to your own decisions about that matter. But you're correct. I mean, he was in the best position to do that. But I still believe that based upon the decisions that this court has made in other cases, that there is certainly a sufficient basis for this court to overrule the judge's decision in that respect. The sort of dovetail into that argument is the fact that not only was the child not competent to testify, but she was unavailable as a witness. And again, the two arguments sort of blend together with the same result, is that even though the child is present in court to testify, if she is unable to give meaningful testimony, then this court has declared in previous cases that she is unavailable as a witness. Now, the importance of that relates to SDCL 19-16-38, which we've alleged in this case is unconstitutional, and even if constitutional, was not followed by the procedure was not properly followed by the court. Because under the standards of that statute, if the child is declared unavailable, then it's incumbent upon the state to provide corroborating evidence of the crime. In this case, there is none. In this case, the state had DNA evidence, DNA analysis tested by the state chemist out in Pierre, who testified on behalf of the defendant that there is simply no DNA matchup between the items that they tested and my client. The young child was examined by a physician shortly after the allegations. Again, no evidence that the physician was able to testify that there was anything that had been done to this child that would show that there had been any touching or anything like that of the areas in question that would give her cause for concern. So it's simply this case rests upon the testimony of the child, and that's it. And otherwise, the state has no other evidence to corroborate that.
There was some evidence, wasn't there, that the child and this new client were alone together. There was some testimony about that.
Correct. My client was babysitting the child for approximately a day and a half, but no physical evidence to show that my client had any contact with the minor child, other than what the minor child's statements that she made to her mother and to others.
What about your client's statement? I know you're accusing him of that suppressed. Did he make any admissions in that statement?
No, Your Honor. No admissions as it relates to the issues in this case.
Why do you want to suppress him?
Because he made admissions that, again, paint him out to be maybe not the regular Joe on the street that you would expect to encounter, and some actions that he had performed that he stated while he was at that residence in his own room, and that has to do with masturbating, and again, we just felt that the introduction of that evidence into the testimony, again, paints my guy in a negative light in the eyes of the jury, regardless of whether or not he had anything to do with the committing of the crime that he was charged with. So going back to the statute 19-16-38, and again, the other part of that argument, Your Honors, is I believe that that statute is unconstitutional because of the fact that it was enacted shortly after the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Ohio versus Roberts, and that had to do with the test. The key words are the indicia of reliability, and that was the buzzword that came out of the Roberts decision, which, of course, as you know, was overturned by the Crawford decision by the U.S. Supreme Court here a couple of years ago. And therefore, and it's clear that in the Crawford court, they clearly state that the decision in Ohio versus Roberts is abrogated. That being the case, if 1916-38 is premised upon the Roberts decision, then that statute has to be unconstitutional, and it has to be rewritten or form with the Crawford decision. And the state would argue, and I'll probably leave that to rebuttal, that so what? It didn't have anything to do with this case, but it really did, because obviously the state had to file the notice of intent to introduce evidence of the or the statements that the child made to law enforcement, and which they did. Going on, Your Honor, as I said, the case started out on a bad note, I believe, and it ended on a bad note. I think that the comments made by the state's attorney in closing argument in referring to my client, or insinuating at least that my client was a pervert, I believe was highly improper. Now, I did not object at that time. You know, frankly, it caught me by surprise that that the state's attorney made that statement. And so I'm sitting there wondering, well, what do I do? You know, do I object? And if I do object, I'm just calling the juror's attention, you know, more so to that statement, and whether that's going to do me any good, even if the court or sustains my objection. And so I was kind of in a quandary of what to do. But nonetheless, I think it was improper for the state's attorney to comment on that. The purpose of the closing arguments is just for each side to give a recitation of what they believe the facts of the case proved.
Mr. O'Brien, that statement came in through a video originally. Was the video shown to the jury?
That statement came in, Your Honor, when the police were interrogating my client at the time of the initial interview by the police. And there were statements. I think what happened, Your Honor, is that my client did not make that statement. He was referring to an uncle, the child's uncle, who he claims referred to the child as a pervert. And so, and that's why I feel it was unfair for the state to insinuate that my client made that statement in the first place when he didn't. But that's how that came in.
But couldn't you have asked the court to approach the bench and have the prosecutor come to the bench and then ask the court to go on the record outside the presence of the jury and raise your objection then in order to preserve it?
Well, looking back, Your Honor, that's probably what I should have done. But
but you probably knew that going in, didn't you? You just got surprised with when it came out.
Certainly. And you know, I had, you know, other things on my mind that I was ready to argue, and so I think that the court could address that issue under the plain error rule. And we did file the post-trial
Two
motion
minutes.
On that. Thank you. Second trial, several things, Your Honor, that that the defendant objects to, and that basically has to do with the exhibits that were introduced. We feel that there was information contained in the exhibits which was, again, prejudicial to my client and had nothing to do with determining whether or not if he was the same person that was previously convicted of prior felonies. The display of physical evidence, again, the state required that he display his tattoo, which happened to be a skull and bones. And again, we feel that the only reason for that was to, again, paint my guy in a bad light and to prejudice him. The state had already introduced photographs of my client into evidence. They had already introduced fingerprints of my client into evidence. And so they had proper proper identification of my client, and there was no reason to have to go into that displaying of the tattoos.
But by going to trial, the state had the obligation to prove this. And the tattoo certainly would be very probative that he is the same person.
Well, I think it was at that point in time, Your Honor, I think the evidence was cumulative, that they had already introduced the photographs. They had already introduced the fingerprints, and that should have been sufficient, I believe.
Well, haven't we said repeatedly, though, we're not going to tell the state how to prove its case? Burden rests with them, doesn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor. But I think, again, they're bound by the rules of evidence, and that everyone should play fairly, and that I think that they were going overboard with this evidence. I believe my time is probably up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Campbell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
I'd like to thank the court for this opportunity to address the defendant's concerns. A little bit of background on this case. What happened here was that on October 1st, 2003, that's 3 years ago last Sunday, the defendant was staying with the victim's family. During the evening, most of the family was watching a video downstairs, and after a certain amount of time, the defendant and the child separately went to the second floor. The child went up to play with some toys, she said, and the defendant was apparently on the computer looking at pornography or whatever. He at various points in his statement to the police indicated that he was masturbating either before or after the four-year-old girl came into the room where he was doing this. Now, all of this comes down to, really, the voluntariness of his statements. Was he entitled to Miranda because he was supposedly under, in custody? And how does all this fit in with the child's statements? And did the child, at the various stages of the prosecution, exhibit the ability to be competent to testify and to remember? To all of these things, I say the record weighs heavily in the state's favor. Regarding the statement to the police, what's left out is that he called the police. He initiated the contact. He had apparently heard that the police wanted to talk to him, and he called the police. He agreed that they could come pick him up, take him to the station. They went to the station. They went downstairs into the basement. Lasted about 90 minutes, 85 minutes, 95 minutes. That's a pretty short interrogation, if you want to call it that. I mean, interrogations can go on for 6 or 8 hours.
Without Miranda warnings?
Yeah. That happened in the Deb Jenner case back in the...
Right. It was a 3-2 decision, and
I know
then
it
went up to Supreme Court, and it was affirmed, or it went to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right, and I know that you disagreed with it.
Right, along with another justice.
Yes. But this
is certainly not a model for, I mean, we're not arguing about that case.
But, no.
But I don't think you can say that an interrogation can go on for 6 or 8 hours without Miranda warnings and that the evidence is still admissible.
I think it depends on the circumstances. If you have a very harsh confrontational inquisition, then I would agree with you that that would be beyond the pale. But here, that's not the case. The interrogation was not that confrontational. It's there initiated by the defendant. An interesting point here, which was touched on in Mr. O'Brien's presentation, is that he never actually confessed. Now, the ultimate question here regarding voluntariness, regarding custody, is his will overborne? Is he free? Does he feel that he's free to leave? He was told right at the outset that he was free to leave by the officers. He was willing to stay and talk. At the end, he disengaged himself, and the officers took him home. You look at all of that, the totality of the circumstances, he was not in custody. Miranda was not necessary, and his statements were clearly voluntary. Moving on to the grand jury proceedings, if there are no further questions on that issue. No, I think he wasn't taken into custody until a very long time later, like weeks or a couple of months.
So when the 90 minutes ended, they told him he's free to go.
Well, when the 90, at the end, I think he asked to leave, or he asked to stop the questioning, and they did, and they took him home. So again, that's all part of the totality of the circumstances, and I think clearly that the Miranda issue is without merit. Now, going on to the grand jury proceedings, I mean, this court has held, I believe in 2003 it was, that this court does not look to the does not look at the evidence that the grand jury considered. It's sort of like the principle that an illegal arrest does not invalidate a subsequent conviction. And the purpose of the grand jury, it's sort of a gatekeeping function to see, well, is there enough here to keep the guy? And here, there was. Now, there may have been irregularities. Mr. O'Brien argues that the state's attorney was way out of line regarding, he asked the mother, I think, was she aware of his record or history when she let him stay there with her child? And she said, well, she was aware that he'd been in the pen for grand theft or something. Now, there was no follow-up to that. There was no further exploration of that. I don't think there was any attempt by the state to exploit that overly. I don't think the question was intended to elicit that. And in the context of the entire proceeding, it was harmless error. Now, regarding the leading questions issue, there were a lot of leading questions at the grand jury. But this court does not look at an allegation of incompetent or hearsay evidence. You don't look at what he's asking you to look at. Again, it's a very preliminary stage. Is there enough to bind him over? And the conviction at trial by a jury really washes out that error.
What does it mean then when the statute requires that the rules of evidence apply to a preliminary hearing?
Well, it also says that there's a separate statute that says that they have to be substantially followed. I think what the point of that is that you can't really turn a grand jury into a kangaroo court. There has to be some evidentiary basis to what's going on. There has to be some, you know, procedure. But a grand jury is a much less formal enterprise than a trial. You don't have defense counsel, and, you know, given the differences, I mean, you have a very different burden of proof. I mean, all you have to have is probable cause to believe that a crime was, you know, committed by the defendant. I mean, that is so totally different from a trial where it's beyond reasonable doubt.
But that's a burden of proof, mm-hmm. as opposed to rules of evidence.
Sure. Now, the same chapter has a statute that says, you know, this chapter has to be substantially complied with. Substantially complied with is a bit lesser than total, absolute, rigid following of the rules of evidence. And I think it was a Vatney case would support the state on that. Given the conviction at trial, I think that the grand jury complaints are essentially irrelevant.
What about this child's testimony? There were really quite a few instances where the child was unable to answer, and then only answered because of leading questions.
To a certain extent, that's true. She did hesitate, and, you know, you sort of get an impression reading the transcript that she has sort of a deer in the headlights.
Now, she was how old when she testified?
Six, maybe seven. She was four at the time of the crime, and this was about two years later. I think under McKinney, she's both competent to testify and available. In McKinney, you had very much of the same situation with an older child. The child there, I believe, was 9 years old. And there were inconsistent statements. There were, I think, as many as 20 instances of her saying, I don't know, or not answering. And I think that under McKinney, this child does exhibit sufficient capability to be available and to testify. And that did give the defense an adequate opportunity to cross-examine. Now, it's an opportunity to cross-examine. It's not, what's constitutionally required is not that the defendant be able to cross-examine to whatever extent he wishes. Actually, as McKinney indicates and as a lot of other case law indicates, you can have, as a matter of fact, although this is not in the briefs, and I admit that, there's a 2006 Illinois case talking about how you had an adult witness who'd been hit on the head and no longer remembered the statements. And yet the court held that he was, that was sufficient for confrontation.
Of course, it has to be a meaningful cross-examination as well.
Well,
not just the
yes,
opportunity.
Yes, it has to be meaningful, but it doesn't have to be as useful as the defendant would like.
How much cross-examination was done in this case of the
it
child?
It was very aggressive. Mr. O'Brien, during direct, he objected strenuously. He cross-examined her and re-cross-examined her, very much. And I'm actually surprised that she held up as well as she did. I mean, there were a couple of points that were, he asks her a question, she responds remembering whatever the topic was. And this happened at least twice. And he comes back with, oh, and how do you remember that? And I don't know his tone of voice at the time, but it looked, if you're 6 years old and in a trial surrounded by adults and lights and you're being cross-examined by an adult lawyer, you've got to expect things like that. And that's one reason, I think, why 1916-38 was enacted, because society does not allow a defendant to get away with a crime merely because he has victimized those that are least able to defend themselves.
You balance that, however, with, as Justice Sinner said, all of our experiences. If you've had children or been around young children, they do not have a strong capability of recalling, and their imaginations may be a little more active than when we're adults. So you have to balance that. Was that protected enough here for the defendant?
I believe it was. And another thing is that, the trial testimony does not stand by itself. There was a pretrial hearing which happened before Carothers 1, which was the issue about whether there had to be a pre-existing opportunity to cross-examine, regardless of whether the child testified. And you have her statements to Colleen Brazil, you have her statements to Officer Hader, you have her statement to her mother. And if you look at those all along the timeline, she does present a fairly consistent picture. She does indicate that the defendant touched her vagina. She does indicate that it happened several times. She indicates that he was always trying to kiss her. If you look at trial, she does show memory of that. And it's not completely consistent. There are parts throughout all the proceedings where she stops, where she halts, where she doesn't seem to understand. And then, a page or two later, yes, she does remember that.
What other evidence corroborates her story?
Well, actually, there's a good deal of corroboration you have the testimony of the mother that Carothers was there, that they were upstairs together. You have his own statements in his interview that he was there, that she came in and he hugged her and that. So you do have You do have corroboration. There's no physical corroboration that's true as far as injury to her body. But the doctor testified at trial that that was to be expected. I mean, this was, you know, he examined her sometime afterwards, and, you know, however negatively one looks at the defendant's crimes, and they are bad. It wasn't an especially violent crime. It's not, you know, there are cases where there are just brutal injuries inflicted on victims, and this was not one of those cases. It was a lesser degree of contact and penetration that he put his fingers in her vagina, and you know, there's a lot of other details. But another bit of corroboration is that she had indicated that the defendant had blocked the door behind him with a spoon, and there was a spoon found there. It is corroboration, and the corroboration in this situation is really not required. The corroboration comes in if under 1638 the child would be unavailable and or not competent, and that was not the case here. She did testify. He had the opportunity to cross-examine.
Now remind me, when Judge Dienapp made the decision that the child was available and competent to testify, he had seen her testify a couple times, I think, as I recall. And then, was there other testimony, however, from other people to indicate her level of intelligence or capability of any sort?
Her mother testified that she was very advanced intellectually. I don't know whether that's a mother's pride or not, but that was at least some indication. And I believe Colleen Brazil, now she interviewed the child on tape, and that is in evidence, and it's, you know, available to the court. And you look at that, and, you know, Colleen testified that the child was, you know, she was able to recall and to testify. If you look at that video, you don't come across with a position that this child is incompetent. It really isn't there. I think that in the context of the entire proceeding, in the video, in the hearings, and at trial where Judge Dienapp had an opportunity to observe the girl, I think he had a sufficient basis to make those rulings, and I think that should be upheld. I think, you know, the case law indicates that one of the functions of cross-examination is to give the jury the opportunity to observe the witness and observe their demeanor and judge from that their credibility. So I think that under McKinney and other cases that what happened here was proper. And I think Judge Dienapp was correct. If there are no further questions on that, I'd like to move on to the habitual offender proceedings. Now,
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Okay. 1916-38, as far as whether it's unconstitutional or not, I mean, this was applied in McKinney. Parts of it are unconstitutional, but they're not unconstitutional as applied to this client. And under the case law, I don't think that the defendant's argument goes anywhere. Regarding the habitual offender proceedings, that's really all governed by State v. Stuck. You have the paperwork that comes in. You have the legal questions of status, whether the prior crimes are single transactions, whether they're crimes of violence. I think the case law is clear that those are matters for the court, not for the jury. By statute, the issue before the jury is identification. And to identification, that's where all that evidence goes. It's where the evidence of the tattoo goes under Noche. And I really think that there's nothing really objectionable in the habitual offender proceedings. Now, in closing, I would just like to ask the court to affirm Judge Gienapp and the verdict of the jury. I think what happened here, he got a fair trial. If there are no questions, I will sit.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Brien, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, again, going back to the grand jury proceedings, and I was curious as to why Mr. Campbell made the statement that the state's attorney's question to the witness was not intended to solicit that information. Well, that begs the question why he asked the question in the first place. I assume you were unfamiliar with his record. What response did he expect to receive based upon that question, other than either yes, she was, or no, she wasn't? And obviously, she stated that she was and proceeded to state to the jury that he had been in prison before. The grand jury proceedings are a substitute for a preliminary hearing. And obviously, a judge would not allow in a preliminary hearing what occurred in this grand jury proceeding. Obviously, defense counsel is not given the opportunity to participate in the grand jury proceedings. Nonetheless, the procedures that should be followed by the state's attorney in those grand jury proceedings should be no less different, or the rules of evidence should be no different, differently followed in grand jury proceedings than in preliminary hearings. And so I think there's a burden on the state's attorney to follow the rules of evidence. Sure, the court does not look at the evidence, but I think the court should look at the procedure that's being followed by the state's attorneys to prevent what Mr. Campbell indicated to be a kangaroo court. Now, his statements regarding cross-examination of the minor child, I would take exception to the word aggressive. Obviously, any cross-examination of the child in the presence of the jury, one has to be careful not to look like you're bullying a small child on the witness stand. That certainly did not occur in this case.
What, was it a meaningful cross-examination?
Well, depending on the term meaningful, but I don't believe that there was any meaningful information that was provided by the child either during the direct examination or the cross-examination.
But she was able to answer or to respond to your cross-examination questions.
At times she was, but at times she wasn't. And that was true during the direct examination. And again, I think that the testimony that came out was the testimony that was provided by the state's attorney in the form of leading questions.
Now, you objected to those, did you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And those were usually sustained, weren't they, when
and
you
they
objected?
They were, and about a minute later, that same question would come again by the state's attorney. And again, that was another basis of our appeal in this case, is that we believe the state's attorney went over the line that he should have followed in his questioning of the minor child. So, Your Honor, I believe that the court ought to look at the facts of this case and to make that determination, and not really, you can't really rely upon the facts of any other case except to see how the facts of this case may differ or be the same as the facts of any other case. The issue, I guess, we didn't talk about too much was, and I asked this court to again reconsider its previous decision in the Crawford case. And basically that had to do with the fact that, if the child is available to testify, then it's okay to go ahead and let the evidence in of the statement she gave to law enforcement and the statement she gave to a child's voice. And I asked the court to reconsider your decision in that case. And here's why. Why, if the child is there to testify and assumingly can give competent and meaningful testimony, she should be able to testify at the time of trial as to the statements she gave to law enforcement or as to the statements she gave to a child's voice at the time right after this allegedly occurred. And so why is it necessary for law enforcement, or why is it necessary for the people at Child's Voice to testify as to what the child told her if the child is there physically at the time of the trial to give that same testimony? And I believe the answer is that it's not. It's not necessary that you be able to introduce into evidence those statements that she previously made, because she's there, right there, to give those statements now. So I'd ask on that basis, Your Honor, that, and I think this gives the court the opportunity to be the first court, I believe, in this nation to correctly interpret what I believe the gist of the Crawford decision was regarding that particular issue. And I remind the court that particular issue came about as a minor footnote 9 or 12, in this lengthy Supreme Court decision in the Crawford case. And again, Judge Genap has stated it much more eloquently and better than I have, but he had good reasons for making his decision in the first place. So I'd ask this court to reconsider that. Finally, regarding the second trial, Your Honor, the statement was made, well, all we have to do at the second trial is to identify the defendant. But the statute really calls for more than that. And it's a two-part test. If the prior conviction, for example, under 2277, if the prior conviction is a felony, and was the defendant the same person convicted of that prior felony? So again, that has to go with one of my arguments, is that, well, who makes that determination? And the statute obviously is silent as to whether it's the court's function or the jury's function. And so I think that under our general principles of a right to trial and a right to a jury determination, that it's the function of the jury to make those determinations and not the court. With that, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.